The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. For the most comprehensive industry news and information, visit our website at irei.com and sign up for our free daily news alerts.
You were pretty emphatic when you wrote, Fulcrum does not recommend and never has recommended hedge funds.
No.
What about hedge funds? Is it what don't you like about hedge funds?
I guess when I was writing that last night, I didn't need to be so emphatic about it. It doesn't mean we'll necessarily avoid them in the future. While we are very familiar with hedge funds, Darcy, my business partner, and I serve on major, $500 million endowments each. So we see hedge funds. We have in the past, and I have in my prior capacity at other firms, invested in hedge funds. So it's not something that Fulcrum has done. It is something that our people here, our investment team, as well as our managing partners, have done in the past and will do in those capacities. But for our clients, we've chosen an approach to be more true to our beliefs and values. So we go back to our fundamental investment philosophy, and we can get into that in more detail. And one of the fallouts from that is the hedge funds, in general, as a structure, we don't really view that as an asset class, although we know it is also considered an asset class, are not appropriate for some of the goals that we need to for our clients, that we're trying to achieve for our clients. So it's a result of our investment philosophy, not necessarily a bias against hedge funds in particular.
Well, you also mentioned that you're wary of the pitfalls of over-diversification. I like this phrase you use, rather than the spray and pray method. We strive to know what we own. So do you see, you're not the first person. I had talked to somebody, interviewed somebody before, who said one of the biggest issues they face with new clients is that they need to, that they're over-diversified. It's really kind of what you're saying, in that you don't really know what's working and what isn't working when you have got so many different variables at play. Now, that was her take on it, but what's yours? Mm-hmm. Is that basically
it? It's similar. It's related, and I concur with that we strive to be intimately familiar with our holdings. We want to know what we own and why we own it and what the impact is on the overall portfolio. And we think that, for instance, within the large cap U.S. equity space, a portfolio of 30 to 50 stocks can achieve almost all of the risk reduction benefits of a 1,000 stock portfolio or an index. And an index or fund, if you include lots and lots of lousy holdings, you'll end up with mediocre returns by the nature of the composition. So if we're striving for mediocrity or average, that's fine. We are trying to be much more intentional about what we own and why we own it. We also incorporate ESG in all our criteria. So there's a way we can tilt toward those values that our clients are seeking in their portfolios that you can't get even with some of these ESG indexes. We can tailor it even further. So we are active and we do avoid diversification. I use stocks as the example, and the same holds in an overall portfolio context. But a little diversification goes a long way.
So let's talk about the goals of at Fulcrum Capital. You've dubbed, you have been dubbed what you do there as an advisory firm by women for women. So talk about that a little bit, the goals of the firm, because you're obviously gender focused. That's a term that you guys use.
It's something we include. We value diversity, and gender diversity is one dimension of that. The firm is 100% employee-owned and 100% women-owned and women-founded. And in this business, the wealth management industry is super competitive, and it's a great business to be in. But 80% of what we do is, if you've talked to one manager or another, 80, 90% of what we do is the same, and there are very few differentiators. This is something we think differentiates us, and that's that we walk the talk. There are only 2% of wealth managers in the country are women-owned, and almost half of wealth advisory firms in the country don't even have a female advisor at all. And I see people claiming, oh, we're diverse because we have 30% female advisors. And that's true. That's better than 18 or 20 that the industry average is. But we're striving for diversity. And for us, that means 50% or something more than 30 and something less than 100. In other words, all women is not diverse either. So we are striving for diversity in perspectives and opinion and ability to engage and interact with clients in and that encompasses other aspects of diversity. It's a challenge in this business, but for us, we do take it very seriously.
Well, what is gender-focused investing? Because that implies to me that you approach a woman's portfolio differently than a man's portfolio. Is that the case, or what do you mean by gender-focused?
Well, that assumption is taking it from the standpoint of the investor, and we believe that not only women should be invested in gender-focused portfolios, but also men and others, entities, individuals, institutions. So we define it by the investments that we are putting the money to work in, not by the investor, the provider of the capital. Our gender-focused portfolio invests in stocks. Our approach is, well, let me back up again. There are two approaches to investing with a gender focus or a gender lens. In broad terms, one is to improve the lives of women and children, and the other is, and this is where Fulcrum is currently approaching our gender-focused portfolio strategy, that's to invest in companies and securities where the management and leadership and executives and policies and workforce are diverse and promote diversity represented by gender diversity. We think that's a proxy for other kinds of diversity. That's one of the better we look for other kinds of diversity as well. The reason for this is that diverse teams make better decisions, and diverse teams, diverse companies have better performance in terms of return on equity. The evidence is available in several studies over the past decade. Return on equity, even share price performance, it's not compensatory to have diverse teams. They actually do convert to better decisions. So we approach gender-focused investing from that standpoint of seeking diversity in the underlying securities that we're investing in, not necessarily to we think that it also makes and improves, and it's not that we don't want to improve lives of women and children, but that's another deeper dive in gender-focused investing. We do engage with other advisors and managers and have some targeted private placement investments that seek that second, or in my words, the first aspect of improving lives. And we do that as well, and we think it's valid, but our internal gender-focused portfolio is more driven by performance. It's a core-focused portfolio of 25 stocks.
So what is the firm's criteria when it comes to selecting gender-focused stocks?
Oh, we've got we look at about 38 different governance and social criteria, of which I'll have to get the exact numbers, probably half dozen, are related to gender and workforce policies. Some prime examples include number of women on the board, number of women, percentage of women in executive roles, parental leave policies. We use. We also do look at some of the indexes and other active management out there, and we find that the data is inconsistent and inconsistently applied. We prefer to go straight to the sources of the data and talk to the companies. It's part of the reason our portfolio is so focused. And we also consult with ISS, Bloomberg, Sustainalytics, and Equileap for some research on the matter. Criterion Institute is another source.
So let's talk about the track record of gender lens stocks and stock funds. How have they performed vis-a-vis stock funds or stock selection that is not doesn't take gender into account at all?
There's some data out there. There are several indexes out there that we've studied with 2 to 3 years of history. And the results are mixed. It depends on the time period, and it is a short time period. And our back-tested portfolio has been supportive of our approach, none of which is audited or that I can really say in to be published. I'd be happy to send, maybe dig up some of those studies and other sources to send to you. My
what
compliance folks would have a
as long as they, yeah, as long as they sign off on it. Yeah.
Yeah.
What is the Gender Forward Fund?
Oh, yeah. It's not really a fund. It's Gender Forward is a name of a philosophy that we've coined, that we've put forth to represent this diverse the approach toward gender diversity in investments. And we have offered a gender-focused portfolio. It's not actually a mutual fund. It's a separate account that we have we launched at the end of June. It's got a full quarter under its belt. It's brand new. We've raised some seed capital. It invests for on behalf of, right now, individuals, although it's open to also entities and nonprofits. It invests in 25 stocks, equal weighted, that we believe are leaders in gender diversity and meet our internal criteria for fundamental quality and growth, as well as valuation characteristics. So there's an active overlay in terms of our stock selection process.
Got it. Okay.
It's unique. It's not an index, but it is actively selecting. We do research and analyze and select these funds, actively managed, or these stocks.
So Fulcrum recently. Hey, by the way, Fulcrum, what's the story behind the name?
Oh, my gosh. Okay, I love this story because, you know, this business is so filled with people that name their companies after themselves. You got Washington, Jefferson, you know, there's all sorts of names, you know, or they name it after a rock or a mountain or a stream. And the founders for the firm, Bob and Darcy, when they started this firm, it was their second go-around at this. Their first firm was acquired by a bank, and they didn't want to work for a bank again because they had left a bank to start the first firm. So when they started Fulcrum back in 2007, they said, you know, this isn't about us. This is about something that's so much greater than you or me or any of us. And but Darcy loved this quote by Archimedes, with a fulcrum and a lever long enough, I can change the world. And that's what she did. She and Bob set out to start this company to manage money in a way that was that they managed their own money and their children's money and their parents' money that was also focused on the values for the world, that we're stewards of this world, that we want to leave this place better than we started. And we felt that clients that are out there that want their money to reflect those values, whatever their values are for their communities, their families, and that's what Fulcrum is. It represents changing the world.
I remember that from my school days, Archimedes and the Fulcrum, and a long enough one could change the world or lift anything and so on. So the firm, are you one of the founders of the firm, Michelle, or were you brought on board after? Okay.
Yeah, I was brought on board to succeed our founder, Bob Kuhn, who retired in December. I joined 2.5 years ago as that plan.
Where did you grow up, Michelle?
Oh, I grew up in Richland, Washington, which is a small town in eastern Washington.
Yeah, where the Whoops, that's a tri-city, Richland, Pasco, and Kennewick?
Yep, Tri-Cities.
And that's where the Whoops nuclear power plant?
Yes, nuclear plant. In fact, yeah, my high school, we were the Richland Bombers. Our symbol was a mushroom cloud. And, yeah, Richland during World War II, Richland was founded as a government town where the fuel for the atomic bombs was produced. So
wow.
It was a mushroom cloud, and they're very proud of their nuclear heritage.
Wow. So describe your childhood in a word or a sentence.
The word outsider comes to mind from my childhood. My parents started me out pretty early. I was a year early in kindergarten, so I was always younger and thus the smallest one in my class. And I was really an outsider. I sucked my thumb until second grade. I spoke with a lisp. I was dyslexic. I had to stay in during recess. While all the kids were out playing at recess, I had to stay inside during recess to draw my B's and D's on the chalkboard because I was dyslexic. And I wore glasses in second grade. On the soccer field, I was so small that my face was elbow height. I probably broke my nose two or three times during my first 10 years of life. And I was also raised. My father was a computer scientist, and he used to teach me math in the evenings at home. So by fifth grade, I was placed in seventh grade math, and I had to bus to the junior high school. So here I am. I'm small and young, and by then at least I stopped sucking my thumb. But I was bullied by the other girls. And then so I was just always kind of this outsider, the quirky, gawky outsider. And then on top of that, my family was extremely religious. And my sister and I, younger sister, we weren't allowed to go trick-or-treating. We could hand out Bible tracts we get at Halloween. So, of course, our house would get egged or toilet papered every year at Halloween. We couldn't watch TV shows or cartoons.
You weren't allowed to dance, I bet, right? Is that why you did belly dancing? Because you were rebelling against your parents? You weren't allowed to dance because dancing leads to fun. Fun leads to sex and all that, right?
Kind of, in a way, maybe if you pull that thread far enough. I think what it did teach me was that I'm not comfortable unless I'm really challenging convention. And so the belly dancing
16 thing, years as a professional belly dancer, right?
Yes. That came about, I was 26 and I'd gotten some promotions at the bank and that I was working at. And the guys are all standing around saying, way to go, Michelle. Now you just need to learn how to golf. So I set out to, this is me challenging convention, right? I'm like, okay, not only am I going to go further than all you guys, I'm going to do something completely opposite from golf while I'm doing it. So I didn't know what it was at the time. I was looking at like bonsai trimming or chocolate making, and then I saw this Middle Eastern tribal dance class. And I thought, well, that's about as far opposite from golf. So I actually took up belly dancing because it was the opposite of golf.
It's also good. I mean, it's very good for you, right? It's a workout, isn't it?
Well, kind of. Chewing gum doesn't really make your jaw skinny. So it'd be nice, but there are not very many skinny belly dancers.
Well, you know, that I was going to ask you about that because I've seen your photograph. You're quite slender. And I've seen belly dancers, and belly dancers tend to be at least a little bit fleshy because they want a lot of movement.
Right.
Did that work for you? Okay. I mean, I've seen slender belly dancers too. I mean, were you always slender, or did you gain a little bit of weight to just enhance the performance?
Oh yeah, no, I was always slender and fit. It was I wasn't one of the curvy ones. But now I do samba, Brazilian samba, and the slender works for that one.
I saw that. Let me get back to the belly dancing because I'm curious about, you say professional. What's a professional belly dancer? Were you going to Moroccan restaurants and you were hired to come out and do some dancing, that sort of thing?
Yeah, I did that. I danced at Moroccan restaurants with people on cushions at my belly button height.
Yeah.
I've danced in nightclubs with live music. I've danced in big theaters with an audience of 8,000 people. So the whole gamut, festivals.
So you studied economics at Whitman College. What did you have in mind? What were you going to do with your degree at that time in your own mind?
When I started at Whitman, I thought I was going to be a microbiologist, but I hated memorizing all the kingdom phyla species thing. So I dropped out of that and found that I loved the manipulation of statistics. I shouldn't say manipulation, but the being able to use numbers and statistics to convey a message, to convey meaning and discern patterns. And so I didn't know what I could do with it. I just thought, oh, maybe I'd be a I had no idea. I did pursue a internship in college at a brokerage firm as a sales broker assistant. I hated it. I absolutely hated it. I thought, I'd never want to be a broker. That's awful. Just peddling stocks and cold calling. It was miserable. But so I didn't know what I wanted to do. After college, I worked in a mailroom. I was a waitress for the first 4 to 6 months. I had no idea. I went to a liberal arts school. I guess that's what they teach you, to be open-minded, including about your career.
So what were your college years like? Were you still an outsider at that time, or did you feel like you fit in? Did you join a sorority?
Oh, I was still an outsider. I think that's kind of been ingrained in me. It's come to define me, maybe not outsider, but unconventional. I did Rush in college, but I dropped out of Rush because I didn't want to conform and try to fit in to join a club. I worked hard. I worked all through school in order to pay for it, help pay for it, and had some scholarships and was proud that I graduated with relatively manageable debt, student debt. So I worked all through college, and I also studied hard, but I also played pretty hard, too. Being independent meant I could go to all the parties rather than just my sorority parties, so it turned out.
So do you take after your mom or your dad more?
Well, I used to want to believe that I took after my dad more. He's logical, data-driven. He's really calm. It takes a lot to get him riled up. He's intellectual. And I wanted to be a computer scientist like him when I was really young. And then as I became more and more independent and as I grew older, I see now that I'm more like my mother in so many ways. She's creative. She's got this enthusiasm. She's compassionate and social. So those attributes are more dominant in me now. I still rely on the data-driven side as well. I'm pretty much a good blend. But I think the people around me would say I'm much more like my mother.
So tell me about what characteristic contributed most to your success in your estimation. What do you think you possess that made you most successful?
Oh, gosh. I think persistence, hard work. I have a ruthless ability to just focus and do what it takes to get the job done.
I like that. That's a good answer right there, a ruthless ability to focus. And your parents taught you have to finish what you start. So
yes, always finish what you start.
So you've been training for that from the beginning. But it's obviously a natural characteristic of yours, or you would have abandoned it. So talk about your financial situation in terms of, a lot of people are savers, and people tend to think if you're in the financial management business or financial in the private wealth business that you're always encouraging people save, save, save. But that's not always the case. Are you a saver or a spender?
I am a blend of both. I'm more of a saver than a spender, but I'm not. I guess I compare it to others, and I know I lean more towards saver than spender. I believe that your checkbook is a reflection of what you value, your personal values in life. And so I periodically just take a 10,000-foot view of where I spend my money and just say, is this right? Is this what I value? Are these my priorities?
Where do you like to spend your money, or on what do you like to spend your money?
I do give to charity. That's a major line item for me. I spend money on entertainment, concerts, wine.
Are you risk averse or risk tolerant with your portfolio, your own personal portfolio?
I am. I'm a risk taker by nature, but within my own portfolio, I'm pretty conservative. I grew up, we didn't have a lot of money, and everything I have I've earned, and I've worked really hard for it, and so I appreciate the importance of it. and don't want to blow it. So I tend to be pretty risk averse with my personal portfolio. When I invest in my for my clients, I do draw from that experience of what it means to what risk means, and spend a lot of time. In fact, I've developed a risk tool to help, or an assessment tool to help clients and institutions understand risk from six different dimensions, not just the risk of losing money, but incorporating all these other, drawing from institutional approaches to looking at funded status, materiality, leverage, and other factors that don't usually come into risk tolerance, you know, the standard questionnaires you see. So risk is a really complicated topic. It's a multidimensional, not just a two-dimensional spectrum. So, but to, a short answer for you is, when it comes to my own finance, I'm pretty conservative.
What is your favorite asset or asset class?
My favorite asset class is actually public stocks. I've been in this business almost 30 years, and during that time, I've seen that public stocks have outperformed just about every other asset class. Actually, every other asset class, depending on how you measure it, including private equity. I think the public markets, public stocks, are still underappreciated and underrated relative to private investments as an asset class. Rifle shot opportunities present themselves in the private markets, but as an asset class, I think you can't go wrong with public stocks.
Interesting.
Over the long term.
Yeah,
I think liquidity and...
Do you have a favorite industry, though? Is it REITs? Is it technology? Is it biotech?
Yeah. So we do diversify across sectors and industries, and there are some sectors that that don't fit our investment approach and philosophy very much. So we'll rarely own utilities and really targeted exposure to REITs. If I'm getting into real estate, I prefer the operating companies or direct real estate rather than the REIT structure in general.
What's wrong with utilities? Is it because they're still addicted to fossil fuels? Is that part of the
That may be part of it for some of our clients, but no, our approach is focused on growth characteristics and quality balance sheets and return cash flow, return on capital, return on investment. So the utilities just rarely make those screens from a quantitative as well as quantitative standpoint. So the sectors that we do favor are those that exhibit those characteristics. They're durable businesses that have been, a lot of them have been around and endured through decades and centuries. You'll see technology companies and healthcare tend to be our overweights, like most growth managers. We do consider valuation. We're a GARP manager, growth at a reasonable price.
There you go. Are you an introvert or an extrovert?
I'm a moderate extrovert. I love meeting people and new situations, and I enjoy being in crowds, don't mind it at all. But after a while, I need to recharge with alone time.
What professional experience did you have that was most formative that really made the difference? It may have even been something that where you felt like, wow, that's turned the corner for me. That's when my career took off.
I remember with crystal clarity this epiphany I had. Okay, so it was in March of 2007. At the time, I was chief investment officer at a trust company, and I'd flown to New York for a strategy and research conference for institutional managers and advisors. And we were at the New York Athletic Club, sitting around the table. There were maybe five women in the room other than the ones that were helping to organize the event. And I think I'd been asked where the bathrooms were two or three times by that point, which is not at all uncommon when you attend these things. But I was not a worker, obviously. I was a participant. So we were at the lunch, and the keynote speaker was T. Boone Pickens, who just recently passed away.
Yeah.
He was talking about oil prices, which were going crazy at the time. And after his presentation, I was sitting at the table with, it was a group of men, young men, these big city guys in their slick dark suits, and I had this epiphany as I'm sitting there listening to them. Here I'm from Seattle, I'm an outsider, and I realized that these guys didn't know any more than I did what was going to happen, whether it was oil markets, oil prices, or the capital markets, or I realized then that I see and I study and I get the same data and I hear the same speakers, and that they don't, just because they're from New York, being there and helped me in talking to them, I realized these guys aren't rocket scientists. They aren't any smarter than me. And it made me realize, it's like a bomb went off in my head, that I'd done all this work and I didn't have to prove myself anymore.
Interesting. So what city were you in at the time? Were you in New York?
New York, yeah. I was in New York City. And,
but you were visiting at the time. Were you
living
there?
I was visiting. I had just flown there for a conference. And what none of us knew at that time was like hours later, Bear Stearns was hours from collapsing. We were entering the greatest financial crisis. And so that, I think that confidence was like, all right, I got this. So as things unfolded over the next year and a half, I was chief at the time. I was in my mid-30s, and I'm running $500 million, and through the crisis, and it was just, all right, I got this. I'm ready.
Who were you with at the time?
I was at Perkins Coie. Perkins founded a trust company and investment advisor in 2002 to serve clients of the firm. And it's still going now. They converted to a trust company. But it's the East Coast firms like Ropes & Gray, they've done this. So it's the first on the West Coast to do it. It's a trust company owned and operated by a law firm. And they're actually the custodian and the trustee fiduciary. But I was the chief investment officer and helped build that from scratch, built out the policies and investment approach. And
where'd you end up? Where'd you end up? AUM-wise there?
I was there we went from zero to $500 million while I was there in 9 years. And then they're now, I'm not sure where they are now, probably closer to $800 million or so.
Did you have a mentor?
Yes. Yes, I did. And it wasn't a formal mentorship, but I do consider my first supervisor in the investment business, Peter Glidden, as my mentor. He's retired now.
And that was where?
That was at First Interstate Bank, which later became Wells Fargo.
Yes. I remember First Interstate. So were you working in L.A. at the time, or you were in Seattle?
I was in Seattle. And Peter, he was a mentor to me, not because of what he didn't tell me things, or he wasn't one of those that asks those probing questions. But what he did was give me projects and opened doors and made introductions to, he saw more potential in me that I even knew was possible. He just made things happen, gave me opportunities, more and more challenging projects and opportunities.
So what attracted you to financial services to begin with? I mean, you were initially thinking, what was it, microbiology?
Microbiology.
Yeah.
Well, first it was computer science, and then it was like, oh, I want to be a microbiologist. That'd be cool. But when I was in college, I loved learning statistical analysis and the numbers and the charts and finding patterns and things. I was also studying computer programming at the same time, and just that the idea of putting threads together that create a solution. It was kind of related to me. And so that's what it appealed to me. So that's why I studied economics. And then later in our business, I grew up in the asset management side, not the client service side of wealth management. So it was the numbers and data and charts and analysis that appealed to me.
Actually, let's move on to Perkins Coie. So Perkins Coie Trust Company, your CIO there, was there anything you would point at to say that was my number one achievement while I was there? I mean, you obviously helped build it from zero to half a billion. So that's quite a feather in your cap. But what else? Is there anything else that you might cite?
Yeah, I think building from scratch, out of thin air, building an investment process and discipline. It's not like I had one previously and created it, or that they had one and I headed it up. I mean, I was 32 years old. So I drew from those investment beliefs to build a philosophy and a process and a discipline, and then implemented it and put the vendors and the systems in place and brought in the people. It's pretty, the whole thing was pretty awesome. It wasn't just being CIO, it was building something from scratch. It was really exciting.
What do you have to say about impact investing and its growing popularity?
I am very excited about it. I think we're still in early stages. It needs to go through some maturation to weed out some of the separate the wheat from the chaff. But in the long run, I do think that ESG and impact investing are here to stay. I think that governance and social and environmental characteristics will be every bit as important in selecting securities and managers as valuation or quantitative or other fundamental characteristics. So I think it's here to stay. I think it's exciting. I think that it is having an impact. Our clients just love knowing that when they come to Fulcrum, their money isn't just working for them once or twice. It's working for them three times. We're delivering performance. Their money is invested in a way they know what they own and why they own it, and that it's aligned with their values. So there's that clarity.
What's the most exciting thing happening in your professional world these days?
The most exciting thing I think is right now recruiting in our business. Seattle is a thriving market. Just the energy here is still, regardless of concerns about a recession on the horizon, we're not seeing that here. The energy in our community is very strong. Our business is good. Here at Fulcrum, we're hitting on all cylinders with growth and opportunity. So we're recruiting. The most exciting thing going on for me and my team right now in our business is recruiting. We just brought in a support advisor. We're actively in talks with some other advisors. We're looking for values alignment, enthusiasm, and passion, really the softer things rather than the hard skills. But what helps a person succeed when interviewing, Peter Glidden, my mentor, this is one of the things that he told me early on, and I appreciate it so much more. Good grammar and good spelling are essential. I think that grammar and spelling, if you pay attention to that, it conveys respect. It says, I pay attention to detail. I think and write clearly. I'm thoughtful. And it shows that you put the time in to do things right rather than take shortcuts. It shows that you paid attention in school and you still value all those things you learned so long ago, and that you value form just as much as content or substance. Form is important. And building out our team just to build capacity for the future and growing the team is so important. I love the team I work with every day. We come in, we spend more time together than we do with our own families, it seems. So we do try to get along and have fun at what we do. A second new channel is opening up through the visibility and the reputation that we're getting as a leader in impact, ESG, and gender-focused investing. And so we're getting some new opportunities just through that energy, that distinctions, the comments I made earlier about our distinctions are starting to attract some new business as well.